Today's seminar. Today's topic is pavement damage analysis tool, or PaveDAT, for overweight truck permit calculation. Before I go any further, I do want to let those of you who are calling into the teleconference for the audio know that you need to mute your computer speakers, or else you'll be hearing the audio over the computer as well. Before we get started on today's seminar, I do want to make an announcement from the FHWA Office of Freight Management and Operations. This week, the FHWA Office of Freight Management Operations released an RFA for off-hours freight delivery pilot project grants. All levels of governments are eligible to apply. FHWA will award up to $450,000 in research grants to explore the benefits of delivering goods during off-hours in small and medium-sized urban areas with growing congestion problems. Working with the EPA, the pilot will look at how truck deliveries made outside of peak and rush hours, where there is less traffic on the highways, can save time and money for freight carriers, improve air quality, and create more sustainable and livable cities. FHWA anticipates the funding will be used to help businesses retool their operations to accommodate shipments during off hours and distributors reconfigure routes and supply chains. While transportation agencies are eligible to apply for the grants, FHWA encourages them to partner with businesses involved in freight movement. The solicitation is posted at grants.gov, and details can also be found on the link that is showing both on the slide on your screen, and I've also typed the link into the chat box. Today we'll have three presenters, Roger Mingo of R.D. Mingo & Associates, Mark Burnt of CDM Smith, and Ulis Cleckley of the D.C. Department of Transportation. Roger Mingo worked for FHWA as a highway engineer for 17 years before becoming an independent transportation policy consultant. While at FHWA, he worked in the areas of highway design, traffic operations, community impacts, and highway cost allocation. He has been involved in pavement cost modeling for more than 30 years, starting while serving as chief engineer in the 1982 Highway Cost Allocation Study, and working on modeling improvements nearly continuously ever since. Mark Berndt is an associate with CDM Smith and is the discipline leader for freight planning. He has 30-plus years of public and private sector professional experience related to freight planning and truck policy. After 20 years with the state of Minnesota, Mark joined the consulting community in 2001 and has managed freight studies for a wide range of clients at the local, state, and national level.
Hello?
He is currently the...
Is that Mark? I've lost Jennifer's voice.
Yeah, I lost it. Okay.
Sorry about that. Got muted there. Thank you for letting me know. Mark joined the consulting community in 2001 and has managed freight studies for a wide range of clients at the local, state, and national level. Mark is currently the secretary of the TRB Agricultural Transportation Committee and is the former chair of the TRB Truck Size and Weight Committee. Ulis Cleckley currently serves as a manager of state and metropolitan planning for the District Department of Transportation. He also oversees the Motor Carrier Division, which was established to develop policies and manage initiatives that ensure the efficient and safe mobility of trucks and buses in the District of Columbia, while mitigating community impacts and preserving transportation infrastructure. He has private and public sector experience related to freight transportation, commercial vehicle planning, and supply chain management. He also serves on the National Academy of Science Transportation Research Board, Urban Freight and Vehicle Size and Weight Committees, and serves as a District of Columbia representative on the Metropolitan Washington Council of Governments Transportation Planning Board. Today's seminar will last 90 minutes, with 60 minutes allocated for the speakers and the final 30 minutes for audience question and answer. If during the presentations you think of a question, please type it into the chat area and indicate which presenter your question is for. Please also make sure you send your question to everyone. The presenters will not be answering their questions during the presentations, but I'll start off the Q&A session with the questions typed into the chat box. If we run out of time and are unable to address all questions, we'll attempt to get written responses from the presenters. The PowerPoint presentations used today are available for download from the file download box in the lower right corner of your screen, and the presentations will also be available online within the next few weeks, along with a recording and a transcript, and I'll notify all attendees once these are available. One final note, Talking Freight seminars are eligible for 1.5 certification maintenance credits for AICP members. In order to obtain credit for today's seminar, you must have logged in with your first and last name, or if you're attending with a group of people, have your name typed into the chat box. I've included more detailed instructions in the file share box on how to obtain your credits after the seminar. Please note that today's seminar is not yet on the AICP website, but I will send out a notice once it's available. I also want to encourage everybody to download the evaluation form from the FileShare box and submit it to me after you fill it out. We'll now go ahead and get started. Today's topic, for those of you who just joined us, is the Pavement Damage Analysis Tool, or PAVEDAT, for overweight truck permit calculation. As a reminder, if you have questions during the presentation, please type them into the chat box and they'll be answered in the last 30 minutes of the seminar. I'm now going to turn it over to John Nicholas, the program manager for the FHWA Freight Office Size and Weight Program, who's just going to give a few brief remarks before we get started. So John, if you can start.
Thank you, Jennifer. As she said, my name is John Nicholas and I work in the Office of Freight Management as the Truck Size and Weight Program Manager. Just wanted to say a few words of introduction about Federal Highway's involvement with PAVEDAT, or Pavement Damage Assessment Tool Research Project. So the PAVEDAT tool grew out of a joint research project between Federal Highway's Office of Policy and Office of Freight Management and Operations. Office of Policy contracted to have research done on a simplified version of NAPCOM, the National Pavement Cost Model. And at the same time, the Freight Office identified a need to create an easy-to-use pavement damage assessment tool to help in determining damage costs of heavy permitted loads. Then that is based on the MEPDG model as opposed to the EASL alternative. So upon its completion, it was agreed to beta test the pavement damage assessment tool, and Washington, D.C. and Wisconsin both agreed to assist in that effort. This past year, we've trained 5 additional states in the use of the PAVEDAT tool: Texas, Pennsylvania, New York, Virginia, and Washington State. I'd like to thank Roger for agreeing to give a brief introduction of the PAVEDAT tool, and Mark and Euless for agreeing to share their experiences.
All right. Well, thank you, John. I'm now going to turn it over to Roger Mingo of R.D. Mingo & Associates. So, Roger, I'll bring up your presentation, and let me get it back to the beginning here, and you can go ahead.
Thank you, Jennifer, and thank you, John, for the introduction. John was a general sponsor that helped produce the PAVEDAT model, and as he mentioned, he pretty much covered this slide, that the idea of it was that it's a simplified version of NAPCOM. NAPCOM is a National Pavement Cost Model that's been widely used, for about 20 years now, for pavement, for highway cost allocation for pavement costs. And it's been under kind of continuous improvement the whole time. But it's very complicated, and it's intended to be applied to the entire inventory of all the highway sections of the country. When we were redoing NAPCOM and improving the models from scratch, it was a great opportunity to come up with a simplified model that could be used kind of instantly for one particular vehicle at a time. We owe a lot to our predecessors in this. The Applied Research Associates, ARA, designed the MEPDG model that we used in the study, and Albert University had done some pioneering work in how to apply the MEPDG to develop individual truck damage equivalents. We built upon that work and used this model as the state-of-the-art for pavement, applied it thousands of times to a variety of climate areas. In fact, I think it was almost 20,000 times we ran the model to derive a new set of independently derived pavement damage equivalence factors. You probably are all familiar with load equivalence factors of some sort. If you ever heard of the term EASL, or equivalent single axle load, that's one type of load equivalence factor, or LEF. EASLs are based on a 50-year-old study that was done in Illinois in the Asheville Road Test, a single location, single climate. It was done quickly. It had limited application in that it really only applied to a very small number of pavements in only one climate region. The pavements were deliberately made thin so they could be tested by different axle loads. They weren't, in essence, real pavement sections. We've been relying upon the EASLs that were derived in that study ever since, because we've never had the modeling capability that we've verified with empirical data to come up with better answers. So as far back as the 1982 cost allocation study, the trucking industry was very much against ESOLs. They have a fourth power equivalent. That is, if you are twice as heavy as another vehicle, it does 2^4 or 16 times as much damage. That was the derived empirical value for the general kinds of damage. And that's maybe not far off for some kinds of damage, but it was very far off for others. So as long ago as 1982, Federal Highway was under pressure to come up with an alternative set of LEFs that did not rely upon the assumptions that were made for the ESOL. So since 1982, they basically continuously tried to derive new LEFs for highway cost allocation purposes. And this paved act makes use of really a quantum jump, and for the very first time we've been able to use a totally independent of ESOL mechanistic model that's been empirically verified. Okay, so what does paved act do? It estimates the pavement cost for a specific vehicle on a specific type of trip. That is, you have to know exactly how much your vehicle weighs, what its axle loads are, what kinds of highways it's going to travel over. And if you know that, then very quickly you can calculate what the pavement costs associated with that movement of that vehicle are. So it's kind of oriented toward truck permits or oversized truck operations, overweight truck operations, I should say. It comes with a lot of default data. It relies upon the same base data that that NAPCOM relies on, which was a wealth of data that was developed for the Federal Highway for the last cost allocation study, which hasn't been published yet. It's been sitting within DOT for more than a year now. But that data that was used to supply it had about 200 million weight WIM data observations, all the classification data for all the states, and a full set of estimates of travel by truck type. So with that wealth of data, we could supply a lot of default data. The problem is that default data is now 3 or 4 years old, so it's really almost time to update it. So the default data probably isn't horrible, but if a state really wants to use paved data and make it their model that they're going to use for wide application, they should look at the possibility of updating their state's data. So you can customize it as much as you want. You can supply whatever data you want to do, but as it is, it comes with data that's reasonably representative of a particular state or a national average. So given that you've already customized it and gotten it ready for your state, all you really have to do is supply some vehicle axle weights and trip information. You need to know the axle weight for each axle group on the truck. And for this purpose, we consider tandem axles and tritem axles, that is groups of two or three, as one axle group, because axles have a different effect on pavements depending on how they're grouped. You can't just look at individual parts of the axle, you have to look at the group together. Then we simplified the kind of travel. The National Pavement Cost Model has 12 different functional classes, urban, rural, but we didn't think that was reasonable. There are broad groups of highway classes that have similar kinds of pavements, and there really isn't much difference between urban and rural pavements in general on the major highway systems. So we subgrouped the highway systems into just interstate, state highway, and local road. And their boundary between state and local, I guess, is somewhat up to the state. So once you put those numbers in for your particular truck that you're trying to analyze, you get results instantly in cents per mile or total costs in dollars, and it shows the cost by highway system as well as for the whole trip. This is the user page. This is what, there are pages behind this, but when you're using PavedAt, all you have to do is apply the numbers that are in blue, that are shown on the screen here, and the results come down below in black. This is a little small to read, so I'm going to break this screen up. This is just an overview of what the screen looks like. But as one example, let's look at what happens if you have a 97,000-pound six-axle truck, or known as a 3S3, that is three axles on a it's a tractor semi-trailer with a standard tandem drive axle and a trailer with a tritem axle. I went jumped forward too far. Okay, I'm missing the user inputs page. This is the result. You have to supply this information, how many miles you're going to travel on the interstate highway system, How many miles are you going to travel on the... Sorry, I'm not very good with this arrow. People can see a green arrow. I'm trying to move it with my cursor. It doesn't really follow, but I'll give it my best shot. You supply the amount of travel you have on the interstate highway system, the state highway system, and the county road system. This is kind of a simple trip that shows a breakdown of just a small amount of local travel, a moderate amount of state highway, and most of it on the interstate system for a total of 100 miles. You have to supply the axles, in this case, in thousands of pounds, or kips. We've got a 12,000-pound steering axle, two 34,000-pound tandem axles. So the number of axles show that it's tandem. The weight is the total for the two axles together. So that was the input for the, I'm missing the slide, I inadvertently deleted it, but to analyze the 97,000-pound six-axle truck, you would put 57 here and 3 for the number of axles. And when you do that, you get these results. It shows the cents per mile of travel by each highway system, the total cost for that particular trip on that particular highway system, and then the total cost for 100 miles. So this weighted average of this particular example shows a 49 cent per mile average pavement cost. And that compares with an 80,000 pound truck that has about 39 cents or about 40 cents per mile. And as another example, let's consider kind of an average loaded truck. If you look at all the trucks, all the five-axle trucks, standard 18-wheelers, they average out to about 71,000 pounds in their operating weights. They don't always travel near 80. So this average truck has approximately 11,000 pounds on the steering axle, 30,000 pounds on each of its tandems. That truck produces about 25 cents a mile of pavement damage. So the question is, if you're going to try to charge a truck, the 97,000-pound truck, for a permit, you want to charge it the full amount of 49 cents per mile. You want to charge it the difference between the 97,000-pound and the general legal weight of 80,000 pounds, or do you want to charge it the difference between the 97,000 pounds and the 71,000 pounds? You get a different answer if you look at the difference with 80,000 pounds, it's about 10 cents a mile more. If you compare it with a 71,000-pound truck, it's about 25 cents a gallon more. Gallon? Mile. or if you look at one other alternative I'd like to suggest, is if you look at the amount that an average over-the-road truck pays in user fees per mile, this is state, federal, and local for both costs and fees, you get a difference of about 40 cents a mile. So it's a policy decision on a state's part to decide which of these numbers you might want to charge, whether it's the difference between the user fees paid or the difference between the average truck or the difference between the maximum legally loaded truck. There's a wide range of answers. That's not the model's job. That's the job of a state to decide what's a reasonable fee. Now, in order to help you with that, you can actually, the model lets you specify a base vehicle. So you don't have to do these calculations. You don't have to look first at what a 80,000-pound truck does, or a 71, and then what a 97,000-pound. In another part, the page behind the main user page, you can supply the base vehicle. In this case, I picked the 71,000-pound truck, typical truck, as a base vehicle. Once you do that, the results that you get back show the net. So here you show, instead of showing, this shows now the difference between the 97,000-pound special vehicle and the 71,000-pound base vehicle. So that 24.64, about 25 cents per gallon that we got manually before, comes up automatically on that user page. An interesting sidelight is an 88,000-pound, an overweight 3S2 with just 10% more weight on each of its drive axles, or 10% more weight total with 4,000 pounds extra on each of its drive axles, does a lot more damage than a 97,000-pound six-axle truck. So here for the 97,000-pound truck, it does about 25 cents damage. For the 88,000-pound truck on five axles, it does 38 cents more damage than the base vehicle. So in that application, if you would like to look at what the effect of overweight trucks could be instead of permitted trucks, that shows you graphically that when you start overloading axles, you get a much higher number than if you don't overweight them. Now, the load equivalence factors are the guts of this model. The load equivalence factors are based on many runs of the pavement models, as I mentioned, and that you get a different load equivalence factor for each of the distresses for each type of pavement. So you really need to have pavement engineers in a state involved in trying to help you weight how important each of the distresses are. Because we get, unlike the EASLs, which apply to general pavement damage, these LEFs apply differently to different distresses. So you have to have some sense of how important rutting is, say, on flexible pavement compared with cracking. And you have to have some sense of how, whether your pavement mix design has more rutting in the base layer or in the surface layer, because each of those makes some difference in the results. Okay, the weight data that's in there now, I'm going to skip over the load equivalence factor. This, in the PowerPoint presentation that you can download, it shows some detail of exactly how we calculated what these LEFs were. This is a set of runs for one pavement section we use, where it shows how we derive the target axles for each weight. And it's kind of self-explanatory, but I'm not going to go over it here because I think it's getting into more detail than we have time for. But in this case, it shows we derive the number of daily axles to reach each target distress level. So, for example, the 34,000-pound 10 that we used as a base, it took 1,100 axles to get the incremental amount of longitudinal cracking, 1,700 to get the incremental amount of alligator cracking, 1,500 for AC rutting, etc. There's total rutting, AC layer rutting, and IRI, which is a roughness. These are the distresses for flexible pavements that you have to weight how important those distresses are, or your pavement engineers have to help you weight it. So anyway, this shows for just a small set of axles. We did this for many different axle weights, but this shows the example of how much more it takes, how many more vehicles or how many more axles it takes to create the same amount of longitudinal cracking, alligator cracking, depending on what the axle weight is, what the type of axle is. All right, that is the load equivalence factors are the most important new part of the model that is common to NAPCOM and to PaveDev. The WIM data came from everything that was reported to Federal Highway Administration during the years 2007 and 2008, which is a small subset of data that the states collect. So we had, even though we had 200 million weigh-ins from 45 states, any given state probably collects that much in a year. So you can get better weight data by probably in a state if you want to update it for a particular state. Now the cost per mile, one of the other parts of the model is we looked at the total amount of pavement expenditures in all the states by all levels of government, federal, state, and local dollars, to calculate what the national pavement expenditure per truck mile was. We took the load-related share of the pavement cost based on recent state cost allocation studies. Most states have not done a cost allocation study, so we used the few that we had the results for to come up with what portion of pavement costs were load-related by highway system. And that's the basis for how we translated the load equivalence factors to cents per mile. And there again, a state can probably update that if they've done recent work with cost allocation or a recent analysis of how much of their pavement costs are load related and how much they're spending. The problem is that in any given state in any given year, they might not be spending enough money to keep up with pavement damage, or they might be spending more than they need. They might be playing catch up. So you really have to look at kind of how much over the last few years a state has spent, and then look at whether qualitatively they're keeping up or not keeping up with pavement damage. And it gets a little bit qualitative. That's why we use national data for this portion. We felt that all the states together over a three-year period, probably their expenditures were probably fairly close to what the pavement costs were that they were kind of keeping up. When you actually try to use the data at the state level, and you can customize it pretty well. Your state can modify the pavement distress importances. You can put in more details detailed cost information, you can update WIM data, or you can combine default data from adjacent states. In some cases, we had to do that because there were six states we didn't have data for, so we used WIM data from adjacent states, and we used the pavement cost distributions, I'm sorry, pavement type distributions from adjacent states in a couple of cases. And as John mentioned, we completed this model last year. We made presentations to five pilot states. So far, no state has adopted it for permit costs, but it's been used for special studies. It's been applied in some form in Oregon, D.C., Wisconsin, and I might add Vermont, because there was a special study in Vermont where we used PaveDAT for the pavement analysis. Texas is in the middle of adapting the model for its own use. They thought we simplified it too much, and they want to have five distinct types of highway systems, and they're developing the data. They have the University of Texas working on improving the data for Texas in a special implementation project. So it's been used in some places. And with that, I'll turn it over back to Jennifer.
Well, thank you, Roger. We'll take questions for Roger following the next presentation, but please continue to type in your questions if you have them. Our next presentation will be given jointly by Ulis Cleckley of the D.C. Department of Transportation and Mark Barrett of CDM Smith. So, Ulis, you can go ahead when you're ready.
Thank you, Jennifer. First, I would like to thank and really appreciate Federal Highway, as well as Roger Mingo and the CDM Smith team for assisting the district with developing the district-wide truck enforcement plan and really utilizing the PaveDAT model to really help the district ascertain and understand what the impact of overweight, oversized vehicles are on the city infrastructure. The main purpose kind of of this study from an urbanized area and the district being a city-state is at times in the past we did not really have a good sense of what the impact of oversized overweight commercial vehicles are to our city infrastructure. And thereby, we did not have really a structure established from a regulatory standpoint or policy standpoint to really address what the impact would be for commercial vehicles traveling on our interstates as well as our interior route system. And so the whole study was conducted to try to really come up with a base number that we can present to not only our director from the District Department of Transportation, but also other elected officials as well as the general public, so they can have a good sense of what the impact is for oversized overweight vehicles on city infrastructure. So with that being said, for the presentation for today, we'll provide an introduction of this study and a little bit of background about the Washington, D.C. area, but also Mark will be going through the study process and the key data findings, and then also the observations that we learned and suggestions that we did learn from the PaveDAT model. And then I will follow up with the conclusions and the direction forward for the district as far as how we plan to make adjustments and improve truck safety for oversized overweight vehicles in our district. So for those of you who are not aware, Washington, D.C. is really a changing and very dynamic city, approximately 70 square miles in size. And we've had an increase in actually new residents coming into the district since 2000. We have 30,000 new residents since the year 2000, and we're a little bit above 600,000 residents within the district. We have the highest personal income per capita, so record number from 2006. But also on the flip side, we do have about 19% of our residents that are below poverty level, which has concentrated poverty that's in the district is really on Ward 7 and Ward 8, which is east of the river. But that being said, the city really in the past 20 years or so has really seen a boom in economic development, which directly relates to how freight is moved in and throughout and destined for the district. We do not have an abundance of the traditional tractor-trailer combination vehicles, five axles and the like, but we do see quite a bit of dump truck activity and a lot of oversized overweight vehicles related to that economic development that's spurred throughout the district. And so when it comes to how we have a transportation network that supports the economic development and something that's sustainable, understanding the data behind what the impact of these vehicles are to our infrastructure is extremely important to our director. The one element that also that the city has embarked upon is a sustainability initiative that the mayor just, Mayor Gray, just released about a month and a half ago that really focused on additional economic development. We're trying to, as a city, accommodate an additional 250,000 residents over the next 20 years, and then also have all trips in the district, in fact, 75% of the trips in the district for residents or for even commuters, that 75% of those trips be done outside of a personal vehicle, either using walking or many of our bike sharing stations and or transit. So this is all in relation to how we handle freight and freight movement within the district. And Washington, D.C., you know, we're a city state. We get federal funding from our gas tax and the like, just like any other state. We have federal aid routes and we have federal aid projects. But from a freight movement standpoint, we are a destination point. We don't have a robust freight industry, however, we're a consumer industry here in the district. And indicated here in this particular graph, we are projected to see an increase in truck volume coming into the district, as volume that's destined for D.C., of about 360% by the year 2035. Some of our top trading partners are Indiana, Maryland, Virginia, and Pennsylvania. We're very much impacted by the regional freight movement and the growth in regional freight movement here in the district. The district is buttressed by Maryland and Virginia, and the proposed different types of changes in global freight flows will have an impact on the district. And so it's something that we want to make sure we prepare for here at DDOT and make sure that our transportation infrastructure is adjusting that accordingly. From a truck volume standpoint, for freight that is destined for the district, we're anticipated to have an increase of about 425%, again, by the year 2035, with pretty much the same trading partners that are regionally focused. With regards to the amount of commercial vehicles that are traveling on our infrastructure, we are experiencing quite an abundance of commercial vehicles that are actually traveling on our arterial route system as opposed to our interstates. It might be flipped for other larger states that have many more miles of interstate infrastructure when it comes to freight movement. But here in the district, the majority of the absorption from our transportation infrastructure for some of these larger vehicles occurs on our arterial route system. So we have about on daily VMT, about 45,000 daily VMT of commercial vehicles that are actually single or single unit, two axle vehicles coming into the district. And again, that relates directly to the amount of the amount of construction vehicles that are coming to the district and or the amount of small package deliveries that occur within the district. So we're not experiencing the high number of combination vehicles coming into the city. So with that as a baseline, one of the items that I've been trying to address here in my 3.5 years in the district is to try to ensure that DDOT has a more robust truck safety enforcement program. And one of the baseline to try to establish this is really to try to get a clear understanding of where we exist with regards to our policy structure. And the study has assisted us with regards to coming up with the results that would help frame a new policy framework so we can be more in line with other states, as well as have a clear understanding of what the impact for oversized overweight vehicles are to our infrastructure. And so, anecdotally, we knew before the study that we had a lot of dump truck vehicles and the like. We had a lot of oversized overweight vehicles on some of our major thoroughfares, but we really did not have the background data to really clearly justify any additional enforcement needs and or changes in policy. So over the past several years, we embarked on the study, but also we really wanted to have the study be used as a catalyst to make changes and have a more robust truck safety enforcement program. And so the study really first took a look at identifying truck safety concerns, and a lot of what came out of the study was identification of where we had high crash areas within the district. But also the second bullet point is really the main bullet point what we wanted as a part of the study, which is to assess the monetary impacts of overweight trucks, come up with that value, so we can right size either our fees and or make sure that we have the proper resources allocated for enforcement purposes. Again, one of the other points is to provide a comprehensive approach to enforce truck operations throughout the city, not just at key locations where we anecdotally knew where we were experiencing high levels of oversized vehicles, but also ultimately, and again, in conjunction with kind of the global aspect from the mayor's standpoint and our city council, to provide a more safer environment for all road users within the district. And so, you know, we've used the Pave That model to move forward. We try to come up with some results, which Mark will be explaining kind of their approach from a utilization standpoint of that model and the results that we came up with.
Thanks, Ulis. I'll start off by saying that this was an effort that CDM Smith did in conjunction with KLS Engineering in Virginia. And essentially, the study had three broad tasks. First was to look at truck safety hotspots in the district and evaluate specific safety issues based on the locations in the city. We also did a comparative analysis that compared truck crashes in the district to some of the surrounding jurisdictions to get a feel for where things might be different in the district. The second broad task was to quantify the effects of overweight vehicles on both pavement and bridge networks, and that was a primary task that CDM Smith handled. And then finally, come up with some conclusions and look at what the district should do in terms of future investments and future goals in terms of both truck safety and limiting the amount of damage from overweight vehicles. So, sort of building on what Ulis had said is there was no formal truck management program in the district. There had been one previous examination of overweight fines that was conducted by Howard University. And initially, that study intended to look at a broader scope of both legal and illegal truck operations, but due to data limitations and other things, it really kind of focused on the fines that the district was charging in relation to surrounding jurisdictions, and it basically came to the conclusion that the district's fines were probably not on par with some of the surrounding areas. So, and then Ulis also had a number of other, initiatives going. One of those was to adopt an official truck route network for the district. He was doing a lot of outreach at the time. This study started in 2010. But essentially, in taking on those three broad tasks that I mentioned, we were faced with a couple of challenges. One is the somewhat limited budget, given the amount of work or the tasks that were required. Each of those tasks, especially the safety and pavement and bridge analysis, in and of themselves require a lot of detailed data and can become quite extensive analyses. So as we were wrestling with how to, and then the other thing is the director, was really looking for some answers within about a six-month time period. So as we were wrestling with exactly how to approach the infrastructure piece of this, had some discussions with FHWA, and they brought up this, new spreadsheet tool they had called Pave That. So some our bridge and pavement staff and myself visited with Roger Mingo. He provided us with an overview of the spreadsheet and how it worked, and we decided that we would use it for this study. Again, it required some manipulation, as Roger had mentioned, but the data, there was a couple real advantages. One is the model was preloaded with WIM data. It was several years old, it was a lot of time savings, and so we did do some manipulation of the existing information to make it more DC specific. But far outside of the district, and that was used to manipulate some of the weigh-in motion data for the district in terms of what we ultimately used as the data set. And then we also used historical cost information for the district in terms of their annual expenditures on both pavements and bridges. So we used the model pretty closely for coming up with the pavement cost estimates. And for the bridge analysis, we basically used the weigh-in motion data set. And Roger didn't talk about it, but the model is loaded essentially with both the raw data as well as a, I guess you'd call an edited set of data that Roger has some various tools that over the years in working with WIM data has come up with some methods for combing that data a little bit so that it's in some cases more reasonable. And so we were able to look at both data sets and make some judgments on which worked best. So to start out, we also had vehicle class counts from the district, and not surprisingly, given the fact that the district's a dense urban area, we see that the single unit vehicles have the most mileage in terms of the weigh in motion site. So single unit two axle trucks by far had the most travel, followed by three axle, and then it's almost an even split between commercial buses and five axle tractor semi trailer combinations. So using the load equivalency factors that we came up with, this is just a chart that shows that the axle counts from the single unit two axle trucks were by far the highest counts across the WIM station, but because the three axle single unit trucks tended to show more overweight axles, they actually had the highest number of load equivalency factors. And as Roger mentioned, the load equivalency factors within the model would have required some additional data inputs from district engineers. And we talked about that, and given the timelines, we decided that we were going to have to use a somewhat more standard ESIL approach. We did manipulate the standard, you know, power of four model based on some more recent research, and also used the ESIL factors for the basically for the different pavement types based on the pavement design standards for the different classes of highway in the district. But this is just a summary of the legal and overweight load equivalency factors by vehicle class that then went into using to estimating cost. We also used the PaveDAT model on another study we were doing about the same time in Wisconsin, and so I thought it would be just interesting to show you the results there in contrast to, you know, D.C., which was dense urban, where the single unit two and three axle trucks had the largest load equivalency factors. When we look at Wisconsin, and this was a statewide study, but it looked at a specific network, their long truck network in Wisconsin, we see that the combination five axle by far outweighs any other vehicle class in terms of load equivalency factor. So just a contrast and example of, given the environment, how the different vehicle classes come into play. Going back to DC, this just shows by vehicle type. You see across the bottom are the commercial vehicle classes in the FHWA classification system that in terms of overweight axle damage, the largest share would be attributed to the single unit three axle vehicles. But at this point, this is only based on the WIM data and hasn't been sort of expanded out to using vehicle miles of travel for the entire district. So again, going back to this was actually supposed to be a slide comparing total VMT to the pavement damage, but just before we went to press, I noticed that the pavement damage bars were off by a space. amount. But again, just remembering that the single unit two axle vehicles have by far the greatest VMT, what we come up with them is that even though the single unit three axle vehicles showed a higher percentage of overweight axles, total damage is greatest among the single unit two axle category, followed by the single unit three axle. And then again, it's kind of a split between combination five axle tractor semi trailers and commercial buses in the district. It's not uncommon for commercial buses to often have overweight axles, and so that does show up here in the data. I'm not going to spend a lot of time talking about the bridge analysis, but like I mentioned, we did use some of the information from the PayVat spreadsheet to do the cost allocation for bridges. Again, given the limitations and challenges we were faced with, we had to make a few assumptions. And so one of the things we did is went back to some of the recent cost allocations as well as the last federal cost allocation. And that information, those other studies suggested that overall 59 or about 60% of costs should be are allocated, bridge costs are allocated to passenger vehicles. And then the remaining 41% is allocated across all commercial vehicles, trucks and buses. Then based on the axle loading information, we then further divided that out into a cost allocation for legal trucks and truck and buses. And then about 18% of the cost for bridges was allocated to overweight commercial vehicles. Then within that, we allocated across the different vehicle classes and again used annual average bridge costs to come up with some estimates of total annual bridge costs attributed to overweight vehicles was about $10.5 million per year. This next slide shows total annual is kind of the summary slide, basically shows how the overweight pavement costs and the overweight bridge costs attributed to each of the vehicle classes. And so total, including buses, attributed to overweight vehicles was about $20 million or $16 million a year, just non-or commercial freight. But again, a lot of that gets allocated to those single unit classes, dump trucks, trash compactors, those types of vehicles that are those single unit two and three axle trucks. So what we found is that, you know, PayVat really worked well in terms of providing a readily available, low cost means to do an analysis that is often very resource intensive and data intensive. And so just the fact that the weigh in motion data was there and readily available for all the jurisdictions was extremely helpful. It was also, I mean, we did talk with the pavement engineers in both the district as well as when we worked in Wisconsin. We ultimately ended up using the empirical method or the ESIL method, but relied on factors that were had been updated, I guess, a little bit since the original studies in the 1950s. But it left open the option about to talk with the pavement engineers about a mechanistic imperial or MEPDG approach. It did require that we do some manipulation of the data sets to use it for the study purposes. Again, this type of study we did was not exactly what was intended when PayVat was developed, but yet I think it worked pretty well for what we wanted to use it for. The bridge guy said, well, you know, oftentimes when you're talking about bridge stresses, it's really helpful to also look at the gross vehicle weight as opposed to just the axle weights. So they said, well, you know, one of the issues they had is there was no means of separating illegal trucks from trucks that might be operating over legal limits under permits, but typically permits are issued to be vehicles that have enough axles to support a higher gross weight, and you don't typically issue permits for higher axle weights, although that is the case in some jurisdictions. And in some of the multiple axle groups, the district does allow somewhat higher axle group loading. So that was a little bit of an issue in terms of not being able to tell which was vehicles that were illegal versus those operating under permit. A couple suggestions in terms of how paved app might be improved in the future for this sort of study is we initiated the study in 2010. The WIM data sets that were preloaded, I believe, were from 2005, and so they were a little bit dated. So one of the things that we thought would be very helpful is that there is WIM data that's available through the VTRIS or Vehicle Travel Information System that you can get at through the FHWA website. And that data usually, I think, has about a one-year lag. And so if there was a way of having the spreadsheet set up so that you could download that most current VTRIS data, that would allow you to get at more timely data sets. But that would, you know, require some standardization in terms of the format. And I'm not a WIM data expert, so maybe that standardization is already there. But if there was a way of also being able to use state-collected data through things like portable WIMs and other things for site-specific types of studies, that would be another useful way of being able to keep the data sets being used very, very current. The cost data, that was a challenge. It was more of a district issue, but we've encountered this in a number of jurisdictions, is that looking at the cost data is not always uniform. It's sometimes difficult to assemble over multiple years. The bridge engineers, you know, would have liked to see more detail in terms of cost repair categories by bridge type, as well as pavement rehabilitation costs by functional class and the type of rehabilitation. So those are my observations. I'm going to turn it back over to Ulis to finish it up here.
Thanks, Mark. So what we believe here at DDOT is that the PayDOT tool is very useful. And again, in a previous slide, Mark mentioned that the number that we were looking for to be able to share with communities, share with our political, high political appointee officials here, being the mayor or the council member or even our director, was $20 million of overweight infrastructure costs due to oversized overweight vehicles in a district. That was very useful for sharing this information with those individuals, but also for us to take that information, and especially when we're doing additional outreach to the industry with regards to any policy or regulatory adjustments that we're going to make, is something that we have used to be able to justify and provide a reason of why we need to really take a look at adjusting our current fees for permitting and the like, but also taking a look at what some of our fines are with regards to those vehicles that are actually not abiding by our current oversized weight regulatory structure. And so the second bullet point is something that is extremely important to us, because when we take a look at the revenues that we assume from the International Registration Plan, which is really focused on vehicles over 26,000 pounds, albeit it'll be truck or bus, we take a look at the permitting fees that we actually receive from the industry, as well as any fines that are associated with oversized overweight vehicles. When we look at that $20 million number, we have really a shortfall of about $12 to $14 million that the district is absorbing when it comes to the damage that we have to actually fix on our infrastructure, because we do not have the proper regulatory framework or do not have a robust truck size and weight safety program. And so the value of the damage was very important, and it was definitely a positive result and a benefit of the PayDOT tool. So what we've done so far is we are working on making adjustments to our regulatory framework to make sure it's appropriate in line with other states, but also from the permit fee standpoint, we can now perhaps take a look at adjusting our framework to make sure it's in line with what the true damage would be on our infrastructure. One of the main elements that we've really been focusing in on as well is really improving our enforcement strategies and techniques throughout the district. I'll show a picture in the next slide. We've begun to at least come up with a proactive way of enforcing oversized overweight vehicles on at least the interstate system, on I-295 specifically. So we can start to capture and at least get a lot of carriers that traditionally operate in the city to be compliant with our oversized overweight regulations. And so taking a look at flat scale operations and static scale operations, but also trying to take a look at restructuring our enforcement activities and our enforcement program to not rely so much on the Metropolitan Planning Metropolitan Police Department, which is the only unit that can actually enforce oversized overweight vehicles, but for the district to take a look at, for the district to really take a look at how we can have the proper resources allocated here in DDOT to have those resources be used for more robust, more enhanced enforcement techniques. And so, slides are moving back and forth here.
Yeah, I'm not sure if one of the other presenters is moving.
Also, we want to take a look at how we want to integrate additional forms of proactive enforcement outside of just having individuals out in the field. Taking a look at, since we are a dirt-dense urban area and we really do not have a lot of land to develop and construct a full-blown weigh station, perhaps there may be a way we can take a look at establishing relative evidence law for the district in cooperation with other carriers, but also taking a look at deploying technology to have some type of automatic citation process and procedure to be able to enforce more proactively, and again, with the idea of bringing more carriers into compliance so it can kind of minimize the damage that we would absorb here in the district. So again, at the end of 2010, beginning of 2011, we did actually install our first static flat-scale operation off of I-295 in the southbound lane. It is about, I'll say, about a half a mile or so from the Maryland border. I-295, if you're familiar with the district, goes really from the Maryland line south all the way north to the Maryland line. It kind of traverses through the district. And really provides direct access to a lot of key parts within the district, Capitol Hill, downtown area, the new ballpark and the like, and a lot of other areas where we experience a lot of economic development. And so based off of the data, what we've seen is that the trucks may not be overloaded coming into the district, but definitely going out, moving aggregate, stone, and the like, going south on the I-295, we would experience quite a bit of oversized overweight vehicles. And so we, at the end of 2010, beginning of 2011, we started the flat-scale operations as an attempt, and again, in the use of the results from the study to create a more robust truck size and weight program here in the district. And so we definitely feel that the study was very beneficial. We definitely were appreciative and excited the fact that we were able to ascertain the value of the damage or size of our vehicles in the city. And I definitely appreciative, again, the Federal Highway for allowing us to use and pay that tool and the like. So that being said, that's the study, that's our presentation, and Jennifer, I'll turn it back over to you.
Well, thank you, Ulyss and Mark. We're now going to go ahead and move on to the question and answer session with the questions that have been posted into the chat box. And please feel free to continue entering in questions, and we'll try to get through all of them. I'm actually going to go back up to the top and go back to questions for Roger, because a lot of those were about just the tool in general, so we'll start with those questions. So the first question, Roger, for you is, Washington does not require a carrier to provide weight by axle. Would it be of any value to enter the excess gross weight for the permit? Example, permit application is for $120,000, and the legal weight based on the expanded federal bridge formula is $100,000.
Okay, Jim, the answer to that is no. You really need to make some assumption about what the axle weights are. For example, that 120,000-pound vehicle, if it's on eight axles, it makes a lot of difference compared with if it's on seven. If you notice in the examples I used, I kind of used idealized axle loads of for an 80,000-pound truck of 12,000 on the steering, 34,000 on the drive, and 34,000 on the trailer. And I can assure you that of the 200 million truck wanes that I looked at, I don't think there were any that were exactly that. That's an idealized load. You really, and I think for permit operations, you have to look at what certainly the number of axles, and you have to make some assumption about how evenly spread the loads are. Usually, if you make an even load assumption, it benefits the permittee the most, and so that's a conservative assumption. But you have to somehow decide how to allocate that 20,000 extra pounds and how many axles there are.
All right, thank you. The next question for you is, did this study come up with a different ratio of the damage done as compared to passenger vehicles? I have heard one truck equals about 4,000 cars.
Well, that's one that, yeah, you could use it to derive that. But in essence, it depends on your state's condition. The stereotype is that using EASLs, one truck does 9,600 times as much damage as one car, and that's assuming very simplistic axle loads. When the Federal Highway Administration did the cost allocation study in 1982, when they first redid the numbers, they tried to steer people away from thinking of it that way, because in essence, cars do almost no damage. So whether it's, since it's such an infinitesimal amount, you can come up with almost any number you want, depending on how much you want to assume about how much damage they do. 4,000 is probably more. Actually, when you look at the total cost responsibility for cars, since a lot of the damage is not related to load, and cars get a share of that, if you look at it that way, you come up with a much lower number than that. But if you're looking at the load related, you come up with a higher number. In other words, I'm going to punt on your question.
All right. How is the cost per axle derived from the LEF? Are they different for flexible, rigid, and composite pavements?
That's a real good question. Yes, they are. Composites, we don't have any special models for composites, so we essentially treat them like rigid. But there are two models going on in PaveDAT. There is a rigid model and there is a flexible model. And the costs are allocated between the two of them for each state based on the proportions of miles we have from Highway Statistics, the Federal Highway publication, the number of lane miles that are rigid pavements, rigid including composites, and the number of lane miles that are flexible for each highway system in each state. So those numbers are included in the model. And if you want to make a different assumption for your state or for the national average than weight miles, you simply have to change the weighting factor for rigid versus flexible. But the default data is based on miles. If you know what the costs are, if a state knows that they spend X number of dollars on concrete and X number of dollars on flexible in each highway system, then you can use those to weight it instead of the miles. It's just a two-number ratio that's on the second page of the model.
All right. Next question, where can we get the software?
I'll have to defer to John on that one if he's still around. I don't know. It's the property of Federal Highway. They made it available to several pilot states, and when and to whom they release it is totally up to them.
Yeah, I think we're still making it available to pilot states and still contemplating about anything further.
All right, thank you, John. Are all state-specific pavement types in the PaveDAT database? Concerns with extreme weather variances and other state-specific conditions?
Yes and no. In MEPDG, we used a variety of climates from far south to middle Atlantic, wet, dry, wet freeze, dry freeze. And those are state specific, the response of different pavements to climates. We used a variety of pavement thicknesses, and there was a surprisingly little difference for any given distress for thickness. What does change a lot is what the prevalence of the distresses are as you go to different pavement types or different details of pavement design. And that's where state pavement engineer knowledge can help the default data that are in there. For example, in Texas, they use a much different pavement VIX design than they do in Michigan, for obvious reasons. They've got more of a, it's much hotter there, and they have more of a rutting problem than a cracking problem. So that changes the distribution of the stresses you observe, and that has a large effect on how much one truck axle has versus another. So in that sense, the opportunity is there to let a state make it custom. What's in there now is just a single set of percentages of distresses that are based more or less on national averages.
Okay. What about axle spacing? Is that a factor?
It is a factor, and that's why we use axle groups. The definition of what is a tandem and what is a tritem goes beyond my knowledge, but we basically group a fairly common tandem axle spacing is 4 feet. A fairly common tritem spacing is on the order of 8 or 9 feet. And we use those in the model as a default. If you observe very different spacings, then you probably, if for example you have a spread tandem that's got 8 or 10 feet between it, I think 8 is about as long, then you're probably better off considering 2 single axles rather than 1 tandem. So just in the same way that the pavement model considers spacings as kind of a typical for each of those axle types, we did that, but we didn't go beyond that. We don't have we didn't do the extra work that would have required to look at what if you had a 6-foot spacing on tandems, what if you had a 9-foot spacing on tritems. We assume the same spacing for all of them.
And then also related to axles, what is the maximum number of axles that can be input? Will it look at a 22-axle heavy haul unit, for example?
Yes and no. Now, if you have special tires and special quad rims and the kinds of things that are used in some fracking operations or for moving windmills, no, it's beyond the scope of what pavements paved at looked at in their inference space. But it can handle up to 8 axle groups. When I showed you the input screen I deleted some of the lines just to make it fit on the page better. But you can have 8 axle groups with tritems and up to tritems in each one. So if, depending on what your configuration is, I guess it could handle up to 25 axles, individual axles if they're all tritems. But the main thing is it's 8 separate axle groups.
Okay. What is the maximum weight of the truck that can use this software to evaluate?
Well, MEPDG, the model, we use the same axle weight input that they use because that's more or less becoming a standard. And the maximum weight is about 41,000 pounds for a single axle, I believe, 41,000, and roughly double that for a tandem. So there, you can model axles up to that weight. And if you have 25 axles at 40,000 pounds, that's a pretty big truck. I guess, what is that, 1 million pounds? So it's not the weight per se that's limited. If you have axles that are more than 40,000 pounds per single axle, it goes beyond what can be handled.
Okay. I think you pretty much answered this in a previous question, but can non-standard truck configurations such as superloads with up to 16 tires per axle be analyzed using the software?
No.
Okay. And can pavement structure be input to the software?
In a way, and this is related to a couple questions that are coming down later too. The model has a separate set of distress weightings for each of the main types of highways: interstate, state, and local. And since you typically have much different pavements on a local road system than you would have on an interstate, you're going to observe different distresses. And you can change the weighting of the distresses for each of those highway systems to account for mostly what you observe, which is a function of what kinds of pavement you put on, whether it's chip seal or thick asphalt, different things of each of the courses. So that's it's integrated in the observance of distresses, but it's not, you can't change from 6-inch to 8-inch slabs, say, or from 8-inch to 10-inch. That's beyond the scope of what can be done.
All right, and I'm going to ask you one more question before we move on to questions for Ulyss and Mark, and that is, how many weight entries into PaveDAT would be considered a valid sampling?
If you're talking about WIB data, you've got to make do with what you've got, but if you don't have 1 million per state, for your state, I wouldn't bother updating because we have at least that many for each of the states we used, and I think you're better off using slightly older data. If you start, the problem is that you can get lots of 5-axle trucks, in almost every state, maybe not D.C., and you get lots of three-axle trucks, but some of the rarer truck types, if you don't have enough truck wanes, you're not going to have a very valid weight distribution. So there's no hard and fast answer. I guess you should look at it and see if it's got adequate representation for each type of truck that you're going to observe, but just intuitively, it seems like about a million is the minimum. I wouldn't bother updating for less than a million.
All right, thank you. We'll now move on to some questions for Ulyss and Mark. Based on the placement of these no truck signs, was it ever considered that trucks may be forced into extremely indirect routes between point A and point B, or is it possible that some origin destination pairs were inaccessible because of this strategy?
So in the district, we spent quite a bit of time doing a lot of outreach to not only the industry but to our communities to really come up with an appropriate routing system, whereby we took about 16 to 18 different data points to try to figure out where trucks need to go, whether it be on an arterial route system or a collector system. Any truck or truck restrictions on any other route outside of that identified truck route system really is going to be consistent with our local street network and some of our collector road network. And so really the issues with regards to kind of having an impact on the routing really doesn't pertain to that overall effort because a lot of the local roads are roads that a lot of trucks don't need to be on to begin with. And so really the assessment was to come up with a system because we did not have a system to make sure that we're sharing this with the industry to make it official system in our code of regulations, so it's something that we can enforce effectively. And so making sure that we do have a system that does provide connectivity in and throughout the city was a part of it, but ultimately any of the restrictions really are not going to have an overall impact on routing for a lot of carriers.
The next question, aren't commercial buses exempt from the weight limit laws?
Typically they are, but again, that's why we produced results that showed, you know, impacts with and without. But in most states, buses are not required to pull into weigh stations and they're not subject to overweight axle laws. And I think that's the case in the district as well.
That's correct, and just to piggyback on that point, and I think the district, and especially other states that kind of have high tourist attractions, this is a severe issue here in the city. We just recently completed a study in conjunction with our MPO, the Metropolitan Washington Council of Governments, to try to come up with the number and the volume of commercial buses by bus type that come into the city. And on a average high tourist day, we're looking at, in total, from transit buses to commuter buses, intercity buses, tour buses, of about over 1,800 buses per day that come into the district. And so when we relate that traffic to the amount of damage that a lot of commercial buses have on our city infrastructure is important. So I think in other states where you may not have as many commercial buses that are coming into to an urbanized area like us or throughout the state, for the district, we're absorbing these costs, and it's something that we also share with our bus industry partners as well, so they have a clear understanding of what we're dealing with here here in the district when it comes to commercial buses.
Okay, thank you. Is there any reference for developing the cost data that you mentioned in your presentation?
Well, it was just records that the district turned over to us on, you know, from their accounting system on annual, you know, outlays for pavement rehabilitation and annual outlays for bridges. So it was just like internal documents, really, that we went through and came up with an annual average cost. I think we looked back 5 years, but we didn't have a specific reference for that. Roger may have a. I know Roger said there were some annual costs based on national averages, but we didn't have a specific reference for the cost.
Okay. Roger, was there anything that you wanted to add as far as the national data?
I'm sorry, I ran off and got a cup of tea. I didn't get a whole response. Sorry. Is this just the cost data?
Yes, the reference for the cost data.
Okay, in the cost data, we developed it from Highway Statistics Report, which is it's not necessarily the best way to get it. It's very difficult, in my experience with state highway cost allocation studies, it's very difficult to get the detail that you really need to make some of the decisions you have to make about what's load related and not. And that's often a major part of a highway cost allocation study. If you haven't done that, the best you can look at is overall expenditures, and then look at someone else's experience and what they found as a portion of load related costs. And that's what we did for Federal Highway. Using Federal Highway data for each state, we did 3 years, the latest 3 years reported, of pavement expenditures of different pavement expenditure types, which is not very detailed in highway statistics. But that is one difficult part of the job, yes.
All right. For Mark and Ulyss, often weigh-in motion stations mistakenly include personal occupancy vehicles as SU2 trucks due to miscollaboration. Did you try to confirm or verify in any other way that your astronomical SU2 counts were not due to miscollaboration?
The calibration. Well, really, we looked at two different sources. I mean, there were vehicle class counts, and actually that's where you show the high number of single-unit, two-axle vehicles. The weigh-in-motion sensors also picked up that as being the highest count type vehicle. But if you recall, the SU3 actually had the highest percent of, like, overweight axles in a percentage basis. But I guess, you know, we looked at the two different data sources, the VMT that the district had collected, as well as the three-way in motion stations. And, again, we also looked at surrounding jurisdictions and looked at, you know, the bell curve of the vehicle class counts from surrounding jurisdictions in Virginia and Maryland. And I guess we came to the conclusion that the counts were reasonable based on what we were seeing.
When talking about legal weight versus overweight, what is being used? Was it Federal Formula B for legal weight, and how much are overweight are the axles or vehicles being looked at?
Well, again, it varies. I mean, what you get from the weigh-in-motion data is a bell curve of axles by vehicle class. So we use the commercial classes out of the 13 FHWA vehicle classes, and we use the district's axle weight limits as the limiters in terms of what was considered legal and what was considered illegal. Those are the basic parameters.
Okay. And can you give more information about assembling the detailed pavement rehab costs by functional classification? Did you look at primary versus secondary designations?
Again, I'm not exactly sure what the primary or secondary. What we did, the allocations were not done for every street in the district. Again, it was limited to what was being defined as the commercial truck network, so it tended to be higher classes of roadways, and what we did was assemble, you know, investment or pavement cost data based on those roadway types in terms of what the district had invested over the past 5 years and came up with an average. So it came out of a number of different annual reports that the district produces. And so that basically, I'm not sure what the primary and secondary alludes to, but again, the challenge was we had a six-month timeline and a limited budget, so I would agree that, you know, oftentimes there's certainly a lot more research and a lot more analysis that could have taken place to come up with a more exact answer. But I think the idea was to give you an overall sort of feel for what the costs are based on the total costs that are being outlaid and, you know, what the weight data being collected suggests in terms of allocation between, you know, legal weights and overweight.
All right. Thank you. Back to Roger. We have a few questions here, and I think we've pretty much covered these, but I'm kind of going to combine them together. And that's if the tool, the states need to differentiate between pavement types, the thickness of the pavement, and the grade or subgrade materials used.
Yeah, and just amplifying my previous answer, the only way you can do that is by distinguishing among distress prevalence on the different road types, because that will affect distress prevalence, and that's what the main driver of the costs are.
All right, thank you. John, this might be a little bit more for you. When talking about changing overweight vehicle permit and these, is consideration being given to moving from a single weight-based approach to ESAL-based approach?
Well, that might be more for Roger.
Is that more for Roger? Okay, Roger, I'll turn that back one to you.
PaveJet does have ESALs in it. As Mark described in the district, you can weight, even though in many quarters ESALs are not well thought of, in other cases they are. So PaveJet allows the option of weighting all of the distresses as 100% ESAL and not weighting the other LEFs. So you can make that direct comparison for each vehicle and see what difference it makes. I haven't done that systematically for all of them, but it seems like the heaviest axles would get charged more under ESALs, where the middleweight axles would get charged more under the LEFs. You can do that for your particular area quite easily by just if you play with the PaveJet model.
Okay. And I'll put this out to all of you, if anybody's gotten any feedback. What feedback have you gotten from the trucking industry? How do they feel about paying for pavement damage based off of assumptions?
Well, I guess I'll chime in a little bit because I've made some presentations on this work in a few places, and I'd say a couple things. First of all, the trucking industry is on record for a number of years now as saying that we're underinvesting in the highway system, and so the idea of paying more is not something that I don't think the industry overall feels is unwarranted. And then I don't think there's anyone that I've spoken to that within the industry that feels that illegal operations should not pay their fair share. That's something. I mean, no one wants to see illegal trucks. It's not only a pavement damage issue, but if you're operating illegally and versus someone who's operating legally, there's an economic incentive there too if there's no enforcement going on. So the idea was here not to necessarily directly charge based on these results, but to make the case to decision makers in the district that it would be worthwhile putting more effort and resources into enforcement, that the potential payback is much greater. So I think most of Yulis can talk more about some of the policy changes, but I think the overall idea here was to raise concern about the need for more enforcement to actually catch the violators in the act, and then if there's some fine changes going on. There was previous work that suggested the district might be behind in terms of the fines it was charging as well.
Right, just to piggyback on that, I mean, first, we're concerned with compliance. And in order for the district and carriers that are operating in the district to be compliant, we have to make sure we enforce the current regulation. And so the study kind of highlighted the need to do that because we were able to come up with that hard number to be able to show policy decision makers here. In conjunction with that, I mean, some of the things that we've been looking at is the fact that our permitting fee structure when it comes to larger vehicles, and more specifically overweight, oversized vehicles, is not in line with other states. And so, it's not a direct correlation between the cost that we've identified as a part of this study to making those permit adjustments per se. It's just making sure that we're in line with other states, and more specifically other states in the region, since we're not a major generator of a lot of these vehicles, that these are passenger vehicles that are coming through the district, that we need to be in concert with our surrounding states when it comes to permitting fees as well as fines. And I'll give an example, a large vehicle, you can haul a 140,000-pound vehicle into the district and only pay $16. And that's something that has been a flat rate. It's come into the city, could travel anywhere into the city just as long as you obtain that permit. And that actual permit fee has not been adjusted in over 35 years. And so this is something that, as a city, as we continue to move toward and having additional changes occurring throughout the district, we just have to address from a policy standpoint. So really, the study and all the effort and the model helped kind of highlight the need for us to have additional resources for enforcement, but really take a look at our regulatory framework.
All right, thank you. Well, I think that's we've gotten through all the questions. If we did skip over anybody's, basically we tried to combine some of the ones that all were related about the different pavement and weather. So we're going to go ahead and close out for today. I want to thank all three presenters, or actually four, including John, for presenting at today's seminar. And thank you for everybody in attendance. The recording and the presentations will be posted online in the next few weeks, and I'll send out an email once they are available. As a reminder, if you're an AICP member and would like to receive 1.5 certification maintenance credits for attending today, please make sure you are either signed in with your first and last name or type your name into the chat box if you're attending with a group and aren't signed in under your name. The seminar is not yet available on the AICP calendar, but I will send out an email once it becomes available. I encourage everybody in attendance to download the evaluation form and send it to me after you've completed it. The next seminar will be held on July 18th and will be about siting of freight facilities. This seminar is not yet available for registration. It should be within the next few days. And I'll send a notice out through the Freight Planning Listserv, which is our primary mechanism for advertising Talking Freight once it is available for registration. So with that, we'll go ahead and end for today. Thank you, everybody, and enjoy the rest of your day.